It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we turn to East Asia as U.S. President Barack Obama attends the APEC summit in Beijing, meets with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, pays a visit to Myanmar, also known as Burma, and attends the gathering of the G20 in Brisbane, Australia. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. China and the United States struck new climate, military, trade, and visa agreements during 2 days of talks as Presidents Obama and Xi made what some say are significant strides in improving often tense relations. Even so, Mr. Obama's visit came during a time of strained U.S.-Sino relations on issues ranging from cyber espionage to human rights, as well as an impression among Chinese leaders that the U.S., through the rebalance of its forces to the Pacific, is trying to contain China. Well, with us to discuss all aspects of President Obama's visit to the Asia-Pacific region in the aftermath of a bruising midterm election to his Democratic Party, and to assess the state of U.S.-China relations and the mixed scorecard in Myanmar, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Patrick Cronin is Senior Advisor and Senior Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. That's a Washington-based policy group. And Dean Chung, he's Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. And that's a policy group based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to you both.
It's good to be back, Carol.
Thank you for having us.
A delight to have you both, as always. And let me turn first to you, Patrick Cronin, and talk about the outcome, the significance of this visit. We're hearing all kinds of accolades about a number of agreements, especially between the United States and China. Let me get your assessment so far of what has occurred.
Well, in general, I think China's winning most of the headlines, but it's true that the United States and China have dwelt on the cooperative aspects of Sino-American relations, and they've delivered a couple of things that were not necessarily expected but have been long in the works and been discussed, whether it's information trade technology, the information technology agreement as part of the World Trade Organization to try to bring in newer technologies, or whether it's climate change targets for the long term, for the 2030 timeframe. These are positive steps. They've also talked about making sure that maritime encounters at sea and dangerous incidents are dealt with in a way that reduces the chance that they could escalate into conflict. All of these steps, except for the trade agreement through the World Trade Organization, are voluntary and could be quickly overturned. Nonetheless, these are positive steps.
Turning to you, Dean Chung, for your take on this trip.
Well, I would say that it was very fluffy and very pretty and, like cotton candy, a little hard to find substance once you bite into it. When you look at the climate change issue, the U.S. is supposed to reduce its emissions over the next several years. It will be interesting to see what impact that has on the American economy. The Chinese, meanwhile, have 16 years to continue to grow their emissions before they promise to cap it. How will we know that they've capped it? Presumably, the Chinese will provide statistics. The problem is, of course, Chinese statistics are often troublingly at variance with other people's statistics. When it comes to military security agreements, the question here is, how is this agreement going to be different, if at all, from the Military Maritime Consultative Agreement of 1998 and the recent CUES agreement from 2014, both of which have actually not done very much to prevent encounters at sea between the U.S. and China. Most recently, the P-8 incident where a Chinese fighter essentially did a barrel roll around it. So I guess the question here is, besides a lot of nice photo opportunities, what substance is actually going to come out on the other side?
Well, let's talk about some of the substance. And back to you, Patrick Cronin. Let's talk about first more communications, military communications, and what actually was decided with respect to the tensions in the East and South China Seas between the United States and China, and between China and U.S. allies in the region. What specifically was agreed upon that will lower the tensions?
Well, there's a desire now to have more direct communications so that the operations between aircraft and ships will not have dangerous encounters, but will in fact make sure they have common protocol and open channels of communication. As Dean pointed out, we actually have an existing agreement with China. And in the past, the problem is the Chinese haven't used that agreement. They haven't picked up the phone, if you will, or if they did pick up the phone or the other side of the communications, they couldn't resolve the problem. They just brought talking points to the issue. So whether this new set of arrangements or new set of promises on the part of China, not just with the United States, but with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and with others in the region, to build more trust and to try to work toward a common, even binding code of conduct, these are promises. We'll have to see how well they're implemented this time, because in the past, China has implemented them whenever it suited its interests, and they've avoided trying to talk about reducing risk when they thought they could gain political advantage.
Turning back to you, Dean Chung, you know, there was another meeting between China and Japan. Again, very tense relations. We seem to have some sort of a rapprochement, some kind of agreement. And, of course, the dispute over the Senkaku, or what the Chinese call the Diaoyu Islands, has been extremely tense. Talk about that particular relationship, how that has improved or not, and to what extent that will also lower tensions in the region.
Well, having recorded a handshake between the Japanese and Chinese leaders, it is a mark of how bad relations have gotten that simply being willing to shake hands is considered a major thawing of relations. Although if you watch the video, the body language of both of them is stilted and stiff, would be to put it kindly.
Exactly.
Where is this heading? I suspect that so long as Shinzo Abe is in fact Japanese prime minister, that there is going to be a fair undercurrent of tension between Beijing and Tokyo. The Chinese have a list of grievances ranging from the Senkaku Diaoyu Tai problem all the way up to visits to Yasukuni Shrine by Japanese political leaders. From the Japanese perspective, of course, we have the same problem of the islands, but we also have a tax on Japanese property and investments. If we can keep the two sides cordial, that's progress, I guess, but I would not expect some kind of warm relations between these two leaders anytime soon.
No warm relations, Patrick Cronin, but do you see a palpable improvement such that some kind of modus operandi can be maintained over these disputed islands?
Well, this is a month of diplomacy. It's not likely to be implemented easily or smoothly as we think about subsequent months. So, no, we've done nothing here to lock in agreements on peace and stability. But these are still welcome steps. They're necessary steps if we're going to move forward. The question really is, what kind of relationship will China have with Japan in the future? As we think about next year, the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, so far China has not treated Japan as an equal power. And it was clear at the summit that Xi Jinping was holding his nose while shaking the hand with Prime Minister Abe. And I think there are huge questions still about what that relationship will look like next year as Japan finally moves forward on implementing things like collective self-defense rights in terms of a law, as well as a new set of defense guidelines between the U.S. and Japan. Similarly, I think the United States feels like China's still trying to edge it out of the region. And there are big questions about whether the peace and diplomatic offense of China has a darker side to it, in which they gently, incrementally push the United States' influence and power out from the region.
Well, speaking of that, let's turn now to trade. I want to get your view on what appears to be dueling trade pacts. We have TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the United States has been promoting. It's an ambitious 21st century trade agreement that the U.S. is negotiating with 11 other countries throughout the Asia-Pacific region, Australia, Brunei. I'm not going to mention them all, but we know that they exclude China. So, Patrick Cronin, any progress on this very important trade agreement? And what about the other trade agreement that the Chinese are promoting, Free Trade Area of the Asia-Pacific, or FTAAP?
China has been all over the trade, economic, and development front in all of these summit meetings. And they've been very successful at garnering headlines and winning and influencing friends because they're dangling so much money, whether it's $40 billion for Silk Road Fund, $50 billion for an Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, whether it's supporting the idea of this free trade agreement in the Asia Pacific. All of those are looking like China wants to do trade and business. The United States, meanwhile, has been promising for a number of years, under the Obama administration in particular, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. It was supposed to be done already. Now it's supposed to be done by the end of the year. So the TPP is in some ways missing in action in these summit meetings, but there's still a very big hope that 12 nations, led by the United States and Japan, representing 40% of the global economy, will sometimes let's say next spring or summer, deliver to Congress a finished Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and a trade promotion authority, a fast-track authority, if you will, to go along with it. If the United States follows through next year and does this, everything will be fine. But if the United States can't deliver on its own trade agreements and only watches China-led trade agreements, then it is going to be marginalized in this region.
Dean Cheung, I'd like to get your view on what was accomplished or not with respect to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which excludes China. And then, of course, this other trade pact that the Chinese are promoting. There's clearly competition here. And do you see progress now that we have a Republican-led Congress, both the House of Representatives and the Senate, who seem to be more trade-friendly, may give President Obama, ironically a Democrat, some kind of fast-track authority? Will that promote or push forward the TPP? But what about this other so-called FTAAP, this free trade area of the Asia-Pacific that the Chinese are promoting?
Well, beginning with the FTAAP, I think it's useful to recognize here that China is supporting something that the United States actually first proposed back in the early 1990s. So in this regard, we actually do see a warming and convergence of positions. Okay. Now, part of the problem here is that how the Chinese define free trade is not always quite the same as how the U.S. defines free trade. Often it's removing tariffs on things that we don't actually trade all that much in to begin with. But progress is progress. And here I think it's wrong to make too light of the shift in China's position towards basically promoting and expanding trade. With regards to TPP, I absolutely agree with Patrick. The first problem here is that the U.S. is the party that's missing in action. This is the third delay for TPP. It was supposed to be ready by the time of this particular summit, and it wasn't. Now, the irony here is that no Republican Congress, in my memory at least, has ever voted down a free trade agreement. If the president wants to reach out to the new Republican majorities in the House and Senate, this is the perfect opportunity. This is a formal treaty. It would be a major landmark. It would be a legacy. And it would do exactly what Patrick said, which is to bind together 40% of the global economy. Let me also note here, China is not specifically excluded from the TPP. What we have said is that China needs to live up to the standards of the TPP. And once it does so, it is welcome to join. China joined the WTO on the condition it would, in fact, do things like uphold intellectual property rights. It has thus far failed to do so. TPP is an attempt to address these, frankly, significant failings.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Patrick Cronin. He's Senior Advisor and Senior Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And Dean Cheung. He's Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. That's a policy group here in Washington as well. And we are talking about U.S. relations with the Asia-Pacific region, particularly with China, as President Obama concludes a major trip through the region, including attending a series of summits. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, and we want to hear from you. Connect with us on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA and tell us what issues you care about. And this week we want to give a special shout out to our new listeners in Poland. And we have a special surprise for you.
Chciałam pozdrowić serdecznie słuchaczy w Polsce. Nazywam się Ania Zalewska i pracuję z Karol, szukając dla Państwa ciekawych gości do programów takich jak Encanto i Press Conference USA. Także życzę dobrego odbioru i miłego słuchania.
Back to you, Dean Cheung. Let's turn now from the trade and investment side to this climate deal briefly. It's been grabbing headlines in the press that the U.S. and China announced new plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, the big announcement was from China. Xi Jinping said his country's CO2 emissions would peak by 2030. It's the first time that China, the world's top polluter, has committed to such a date. And then China also agreed to use more clean energy sources, such as solar and wind, and that would account for about 20% of China's energy production by 2030. So that seems rather significant.
I think that you hit it on the head there with the word seems. 2030 is a long time away. I'm very glad that Xi Jinping can commit not only himself, not only the next generation of Chinese leaders, but the generation after that to something like this. I can only suggest that China's adherence to things like WTO standards should provide a word of caution regarding how well China will live up to these commitments. Another piece to this is 20% of energy will be from renewable sources. Again, whose statistics are we using? What happens if China is in violation? Are we going to go and shut down Chinese power plants? Are we going to have to subsidize Chinese acquisition of solar panels? Not that they don't subsidize already. The third part to this, though, is the reality of China's economy is slowing down. It is difficult to imagine that Xi Jinping is going to be willing to run the risk of greater domestic instability due to unemployment at the cost of environmentalism. I mean, this choice facing the Chinese leadership seems to be stark. Would you rather have a population that is employed, breathing dirty air, or would you rather have a population that is unemployed and angry at you, breathing air that may be cleaner a generation from now?
Well, your skepticism is well taken. So let me turn to Patrick Cronin for maybe a more positive view. I mean, there are certainly grounds for skepticism with regard to this climate agreement. Nonetheless, don't you think it can be an incentive to other countries like India, other big polluters? China is finally committing to something. Maybe it's not enforceable, but if anybody, I guess, goes to Beijing and breathes the air, they'd realize that they have a problem and that they need to at least look forward and begin to set some goals and try to achieve them.
Well, I applaud the United States for leadership. This is an important issue. We only have one planet, and it's heading in a bad direction in terms of climate change. So while I agree with Dean's caveats about China's ability, willingness, and interest in implementation of this target set on climate change, nonetheless, this is a big political message. It's the one that President Obama could agree to, and therefore it was significant. I guess where I would fault in the U.S. administration on is not coming to the summit with just climate change, but also with trade and economic growth. You see, because just as China already has an economic growth strategy for its long term, we need an economic growth strategy. And that's why the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is so important. We have to show that we can have sustainable economic growth and deal with climate change at the same time. Instead, it looks like we're the chumps a bit because we're going to the summit. We're agreeing right now to reduce our economies. China's pledging to lower carbon sort of emissions tomorrow, not today. We're agreeing today. And meanwhile, where's our economic trade? So that's why this is of concern politically. And so we don't want climate change to be more politicized back here in America. We want it to hopefully be a bipartisan issue. In order to do that, we've got to work on climate change and economic growth at the same time.
Indeed. Well, it's true that Washington announced plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions by up to 28% by 2025, and it does appear that the United States is perhaps doing more, but we shall see how this agreement will play out over the next years. But let's turn now to Myanmar, Dean Chung, and President Obama's visit there a couple of years ago. This was a big deal. The country, which is also called Burma, a military dictatorship now, moving toward democracy. But there are many, many problems with the Rohingya minority Muslim community are being persecuted. Political reforms aren't going as fast and smoothly as perhaps Washington would have liked.
Well, that's unfortunately a reality in most places. It's very easy for Washington to expect the other country to reform. It's much more difficult when it's seen from the other country's perspective. But the reality is that the great hope and optimism that had marked Burma's, in a sense, rejoining the global community has often fallen short. And whether or not Aung San Suu Kyi's position in the constellation of Burmese power is going to change, that's one of the things that was hoped for. Again, President Obama, I think, rightfully has pushed the Burmese to loosen up their laws that specifically essentially keep her from running for office. But here, this is one of those situations which does take time, and it is a long, slow process. So I think we need to as much temper our expectations as we do need to hold Rangoon's feet to the fire, if you will, to continue liberalization, democratization.
Turning back to you, Patrick Cronin, how successful do you think President Obama was in his talks with Myanmar President Thein Sein? Are we getting in return for the granting of diplomatic recognition and other business concessions, are we getting what we need in return from Myanmar?
Well, the military is no longer directly running Myanmar, but it's not clear how much power has devolved from the military institution that's operating behind the scenes. And it's not just President Thein Sein, it's really the others with power inside the military and the security establishment of Myanmar. The United States has to avoid marginalizing itself over this issue. We have long been the voice for democracy and human rights in Myanmar, so much so that we isolated ourselves with our Southeast Asian friends who wanted to engage the military junta. Well, now that we have stepped on board with that regional approach to engagement, we have to balance our words about protecting the Rohingya Muslim disenfranchised minority. We have to help encourage the Myanmar political process to keep moving forward, hopefully to change the constitution to allow someone like Aung San Suu Kyi to be able to be elected rather than be eliminated because she was born outside of the country, a rather interesting rule. Nonetheless, as Dean mentioned, we still need to temper expectations. We now are embarked on a long-term engagement process. We also need not just a political human rights policy, but also we need an economic policy. We need a security policy. Nonetheless, the United States, as with climate change, seems to be one of the few countries willing to take a leadership role on the toughest issues that the world is facing.
All right. Well, as we conclude, let me just go back to you one more time, Patrick Cronin. It seems that coming out of the ASEAN summit, also taking place for the first time in Myanmar, another historic move, that a code of conduct for the South China Sea has been delineated. How significant is this in your view?
Well, in 2002, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations agreed on a declaration of conduct with China. It's non-binding. So we've been talking ever since then regionally about a binding code of conduct. And every year and every few months, we have more meetings of senior officials who say we must move forward quickly on a binding code of conduct. It is no more likely to happen sooner now after these summit meetings than it was before the summit meetings. That's the sad reality. Everybody is using the idea of a binding code of conduct to get political credit now, even while they're unwilling to actually be bound by firm rules to avoid territorial disputes, conflicts at sea and in the air over maritime Asia.
Dean Cheung, quickly your reaction to this code of conduct. It's non-binding, so China basically has nothing to worry about. I mean, how does this affect China's behavior, which is seen as aggressive in the South China Sea vis-a-vis its neighbors?
In the last several months, China has managed to basically build an island in the northern part of the South China Sea into the largest island in terms of surface area now. This is in violation of the law. It's in violation of formally ratified treaties like the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. A non-binding, we promise to think about really, really, really hard this time about how we should treat each other is going to probably have as much protection as a palm leaf in an Arctic winter. This is simply not a realistic expectation if you think that this is somehow going to keep the Chinese from running down Vietnamese fishing boats, as they did earlier this year after signing the CEWS agreement.
So not much progress in that regard, notwithstanding a new written agreement.
I'm a pessimist.
That's probably an understatement. But let's close the program by talking about this U.S.-China relationship. So back to you, Patrick Cronin. President Xi Jinping talks about a new model of relations. President Obama, yes, brought up probably Hong Kong and cyber espionage and other little sticking points between Washington and Beijing. But mostly, I think he wanted to portray this as a successful visit, that U.S.-China relations are on a better footing. But how do you really see it? And who's up, who's down? I mean, are we making progress on this most important relationship?
Well, this was a summit season, and there was progress made on U.S.-China relations. It's not a new type of great power relationship. The Chinese use that model, that sort of mantra, to measure whether you're going to be more their friend tomorrow or going to be less their friend. And they use that principle to control you, basically, and to control the rhythm of the relationship. The United States is much more reductionist. We look for practical cooperation. Are you going to cooperate on trade or not? Are you going to cooperate on maritime issues or not? And that's how we're going to continue to look at these issues. But the United States at least has shown the region that the United States and China can indeed get along, can indeed show areas of leadership. On the other hand, the United States looks like we're secondary to a growing Chinese economy. And that's worrisome if we can't keep our own trade and economic growth on track to be a heavy area of influence in this region.
And quickly, before I give the last word to Dean Cheung, What about the role of Russia now? Of course, the U.S. and Russia have much more rocky relations, particularly over the dispute in Ukraine and Russia's aggressive role there. Russia is cozying up to China, signing energy deals. How much of a thorn or an impediment to our relationship, that is, U.S. relations with China, does that pose?
Well, Putin is investing Russia's future by selling so much energy to China. It has no ideology that people want around the world. It has a very questionable long-term economic outlook. And now it's increasingly dependent upon China and China's largesse, where there may be future conflicts of interest. So while Russia is indeed a growing problem around the world, especially in Europe, it is relatively a minor player in Asia.
All right. And the last word to you, Dean Cheng, U.S.-China relations, the new model, as Xi Jinping calls it. How do you see this relationship in the coming years?
I see the U.S. and China and Russia and China as almost flips of each other. The U.S.-Chinese relationship is marked more than anything else by economics. I agree with what Patrick has pointed out. We are the two largest economies. We are bound together in a lot of various trade relationships, everything from raw materials to jet airliners. That's a good thing. It provides both sides with incentives, a lot of interest groups who want to maintain good relations. Where things are a little more rocky is in the security area, not even there, not necessarily directly, but because of allies and neighbors and territorial disputes focused in the region. Russia's relationship with China is the exact opposite. Its economic relations are marginal from the Chinese perspective, and it's largely a sales of weapons and now energy. But at the end of the day, Russia is very much the junior partner in that relationship. Moscow can play spoiler, which it has developed a great deal of experience at doing, but at the end of the day, it has great difficulty driving the relationship. The U.S., as the largest economy and still the foremost military, has the driver's seat position. Whether we choose to actually drive the bus, that's a different issue. That's an American issue. But at the end of the day, we still have the foremost role.
All right. Well, I'm afraid on that note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Patrick Cronin. He's Senior Advisor and Senior Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Dean Cheng, Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, as always, thank you for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.